Hello and welcome to the podcast for Outlander episode 106, The Garrison Commander. I'm Ronald D. Moore, executive producer and developer of the Outlander television series, and I am not in Scotland for this broadcast. I am in sunny, hot, and generally horrible Los Angeles. My lovely and talented wife is back in Scotland, so that means I am joined solely by our obnoxious cats, Oliver, Ella, Sebastian, and of course, Romeo, who will attempt to annoy and distract me whenever possible during the podcast. The cigarettes are American Spirit. The smoking lamp is on, or lit, rather. And the scotch is the Glenmorangie Nectar Dior. All right. Well, this is, I think, one of our best episodes. This was an interesting process of adaptation for this particular episode. This was one of the most memorable moments in the book when, in my first read, and I think it's one of the most memorable encounters for the fans of the series, is when Claire finds herself in the clutches of Black Jack Randall for the first time since the beginning. It's a very memorable event in the book. I like that a little bit. By the way, here we're looking at the main title card. I did purposely put that watch, the 20th century watch, next to the 18th century shaving paraphernalia. It's just sort of a touch to sort of, you know, just a hint of the duality of Frank and Black Jack, and I just kind of like that. But anyway, it's a memorable section of the book that everybody talks about, and it's one of those most memorable passages that you're looking forward to as a fan to sort of, oh yeah, and then she's going to end up with Black Jack, and there's that great scene. In the book, the thing is, it's really only a couple of pages long. It's a very short section. It's a very short encounter, but it's a very memorable encounter. So when we were constructing the show, we kind of said very early, that deserves to be an entire episode. Because even though it's only a couple of pages, it looms large. See, I told you, now they're fighting. It looms large in the fans' memory, or the reader's memory, of the book and of its tale. So we said, let's make that entire episode. It's the first time that she's been with Jack since episode one. It deserves to have a big, meaty confrontation between the two. You've been anticipating it. You've been thinking about it. It would be disappointing if we had dispensed with it just in, say, a very short scene. So we decided we'll construct an entire episode out of it. This that sequence that you're looking at right now, with Claire riding away with the Redcoats, was actually scripted and shot to be the end of episode 106, Rent. And this whole little montage of her riding away with the Redcoats, this was originally how 106 was going to end. And we had another John Donne poem that she was quoting over those images as she rode away. But in the editing process, kind of felt like the maximum point of dramatic tension was actually when Lieutenant Foster asks her what she's going to do. We had always sort of loved that idea that, you know, you put Claire on the spot after the story of Rent, when she's bonding with the Highlanders and yet Dougal's confronting her and her loyalty, and then the Redcoats show up and they put the question to her, who are you and are you here by your own volition, and that her answer, I am a guest of the Clan Mackenzie, was a statement of where her loyalty in that moment lay. And it just felt like you wanted to go out on 106 on the moment of maximum tension and come back and see what her answer was. So this was, we kind of just slid the whole ending into the beginning here, which I think it makes it more of a piece. She's now firmly in the world of the Redcoats from the very beginning. I went back and looked back at the story, original story documents and beat sheet, which did not differ radically all the way through the scripting process. This was always the basic story. The only elements that really changed in any significant way was coming up, we'll talk about the sequence where she helps the wounded soldier. But other than that, it was always this idea that she would come into the world, she would return to the world of England, and the English, be with her compatriots, her countrymen, rather, and sort of be wined and dined by them and make them charming and make them sort of, you know, not jerks, but basically seeing their relationship with the Scots. They're not a jerk to her, but they certainly are to Dougal in this scene. I love Lord Thomas was our creation, whose character is not in the book, and his council of officers having dinner. And we said, let's just put the whole show basically in this one set. Ira Behr, who wrote this episode, We were talking before he sat down to write. I said, you know, this is a two-man play, really. You know, when you get right down to it, this episode is as close to a theater production as the show will ever get. So let's treat it that way. We're going to have one set, more or less, and it's really a story about Claire, you know, on stage with Jack Randall for the vast majority of the show, and the really the meat of the show is there. I'm sorry. It's hard not to watch this episode because I find this like a really compelling hour of television. One of the more compelling hour of televisions I've ever had the pleasure to work on. There's just something about all these characters that pull you into this drama, and I'm always sort of riveted by the drama which happens in this room. This is a little bit of a play on all of the Americans sort of struggling with Scottish accents from time to time. I think I've talked about that before in the podcasts, how, you know, our ear gets attuned to hearing the Scottish accent, and then because of the time we spend in Scotland, and then people in the States sometimes have trouble deciphering the accents in dailies, and we're always riding that line between what's decipherable to the ear and what is not. And so this whole little bit of the accents and Claire defending, you know, the accents, some of the more imperceptible accents in England, to as an example. I love the looks between Dougal and Lord Thomas here. It's just really nice. It's nice and icy, and this thing coming up here with the, you know, the skirt, and, you know, calling the kilt the skirt, and what people actually wear under the skirt, and whether it's an insult to ask a Scotsman what he wears under that woolly garment, as Lord Thomas says, that it's a grave insult. It's really funny. You know, I now wear a kilt with some regularity. I mean, I enjoy it. I did it first as a lark, and then I started to enjoy it more, and I bought several and had them made. And it's amusing that I get that question all the time. It's a weird thing that people, they have this great glee in asking you, what are you wearing underneath that? It's the weirdest thing I've ever seen, and it happens all the friggin' time. People are always asking, especially when I come back to the States and I wear it, I'll be at a cocktail party or an official function, and somebody inevitably will come up and say, so, what are you wearing underneath that? And you always look at them and say, you know, there's only one way to find out, or you come up with some quip or something, and you're never supposed to ask the Scotsman what he wears underneath his kilt. And it's just it's strange to see how it's such a common reaction to, you know, a man wearing a kilt, is everybody wants to know what you have on underneath it, which is the weirdest question. I can't ever recall anyone ever asking a woman the same question when she wears a dress or a skirt, but with a man, somehow this is an acceptable question in polite company, which is really bizarre. You also notice that this is one of the first times you've really seen a fair amount of characters wearing wigs. Again, this was to emphasize sort of the distance and the difference between the English and the Scots, and also to sort of comment on the class system and bring you into the formality of this era. You'll also notice that Lord Thomas is dressed more extravagantly, a little bit more of a fashion plate than the rest of them. Part of that was to emphasize the fact that he's not really a field officer. We, in the writer's room, we talked about Lord Thomas as someone who probably bought his commission, because this was a common practice in this era. A gentleman of means would literally buy a commission in the British Army, and then get assigned. It was, I don't quite understand how that system worked and why that was successful, but it clearly did on some level, because the British Army was extraordinarily powerful military power for many, many, many years. We kind of created this montage out of nothing. It wasn't really scripted that way, but I kind of felt like I wanted to extend the dinner conversation, so we just kind of created some extra cuts and some dissolves. If you look close, you could have seen that Claire was actually repeating some of her dialogue in the montage, and we just kind of blurred over by bringing up the music so as to not to shine a light on it. There was some voiceover coming up that was cut as I went through the editing process. One of the things I've been learning about the show, and I think we've all been learning about the show, is, excuse me, I have to pull this cat off here. Go away. One of the things we've been learning about the show is the proper amount of voiceover, and as the show has progressed, we start to use less of it and start to use it more to specific points of internal conversation and dialogue in Claire's head that you wouldn't otherwise get. There is a little bit of dialogue voiceover coming up, but there was more voiceover in the show than there is in this cut, as I've been starting to dial back on it. As we move along, and in subsequent episodes, there's even less voiceover in certain episodes. Some episodes have only one or two. It's just one of those things that you kind of discover along the way. It's a subjective call, you know. Ultimately, you know, when is too much, and when are you losing contact with one of the fundamental concepts of the show, which is the point of view and Claire's internal dialogue. Enter Blackjack. This was the moment. I love the idea that he comes in, doesn't even see her sitting there. She's hyper aware of it, and he doesn't see her until right there. And then they look at each other. We did construct a couple of flashbacks right there originally, and in the early cuts, this moment was extended because she was remembering their first encounter in the first episode, and so was he, and it was sort of like the two of them remembering how they had first encountered. But I kind of felt as we got into it, okay, the audience is smart, they can remember all that, and it was just in the recap, so let's just dispense with the flashbacks as well. There was also voiceover right in this section of her, like, you know, commenting on Blackjack and how much he looks like Frank in her mind. And again, that just felt unnecessary, and so we pulled it out. The idea here was that in front of these officers, and especially in front of the general, Blackjack was not apt to sort of admit that he knows this woman because he tried to rape her out in the woods. He didn't really want to give himself away, and so there's a moment where each of them is sort of sizing up the other and wondering, okay, are you going to say it or am I going to say it? And when neither does, they both sort of decide, okay, let's just move on and see what happens. So she's sort of wondering what game he's playing. He's certainly wondering what game she's playing, and the cat and mouse of this episode is underway. It was interesting to sort of set her up as someone that is now accepted into the world of the English officers, someone that they've grown fond of, someone that they trust at least to the point of sitting at their table and wanting to help her on her supposed route to France. So that Jack was sort of a danger of, you know, he didn't want to overplay his hand here. It's all, he has to be very crafty, and he's trying to figure out, you know, how he can arrange, you know, how he can separate her from the rest of them. He, of course, knows who Dougal McKenzie is and is angling in that direction. Again, I think I've talked about this before. This is a great episode, due in large part to Tobias's performance. And one of the things I love about Tobias is the way he has shaded Jack and Frank as different people with very subtle things. The way he carries himself, his facial expressions are different. His voice is slightly different, but not different enough that you would say, oh, he's putting on a completely different accent. He's doing lots of little things as an actor to sort of separate Jack from Frank and make them two clear, distinct men, even though they do look very much alike, to the point where it's almost the fact that they're played by the same actor, you almost lose sight of that. They feel, at least in my mind, they feel like completely separate and distinct characters within the show. I never really feel like, oh, that's Frank, or oh, that's Jack. I always think of them as very different human beings, and the way they come across on screen is definitely different. Now, one of the things we played up here a little bit more than is strictly historically accurate is the level of conflict between the Scots and the English at this point. Our historian pointed out to us that there wasn't this is not a moment of outright rebellion. This is not a time of undeclared guerrilla war. He said there are occasional raids, there were occasional atrocities and depredations. But we're playing it up a little more strongly in this version because we are leading towards an uprising. We are leading towards a sense of the Jacobite rebellion, and that the Scots are bridling under the rule of the English even now. So we wanted to emphasize that element. So that's where we got the story of, you know, the private with his head cradled in his lap, sort of as a way of moving towards the inevitable conflict that's going to come to this area. It's interesting to watch Claire function in this setting, you know, as the as a woman, a 20th century woman, of course, but as a woman surrounded by military men, you know, in the testosterone-filled room of it all, and yet debating politics and morality and standing up to them, because it's in her nature to question that. But the further she goes down that road, the more she becomes odd in their point of view. It's one thing for a woman to have an opinion; it's another to press it this far, especially with these men. And Jack is very clever. Jack is giving her, is baiting her and giving her enough rope to hang herself. And I love the fact that, that Jack knows when he's crossed the line. He did it on purpose. He knew he'd have to reel this back. But the accusation is there, and you know it's another way of just pulling her in by getting her, her ire up. He's read her enough to know that he can, she has a temper, he can lure her into danger, and he, and of course he does. And the key line being, it's the king's land. Which is not really the way I think Claire in the 20th century thinks of these things anymore. Of course, by the 1940s, the British monarchy was much more of a figurehead, a constitutional monarchy. It's always been, but or it has been for a very long time. But in Claire's world, you know, she's more accustomed to thinking of peoples and nations, and certainly through the conflict she just went, you know, even though everyone was fighting in the name of the king, it wasn't like it was in the 1700s, where the king was a real force and the king had actual power and things were done in the king's name and it was meant very, very seriously. Now, this sequence coming up is what changed a few times. Originally, this attack, you could hear it outside. You actually heard the gunshots, and Claire went down to aid in the tending of the soldier, but she went out to a stream, she went out to a location and tended him out there. During the production process, to make matters simpler and cheaper, we decided to keep everything in the tavern. It saved us from having to go out on location, and we already had built the downstairs of the tavern. It was much, much easier to bring the soldier in here and have Claire go to the soldier downstairs and go right back up than to go out on location and shoot. This tavern upstairs and down is a practical location on the sound stages. We've been revamping this tavern several times in various guises, moving the pieces around, changing the lighting setup, moving furniture, repainting, and so on, to make it appear to be several different places. But indeed, this is all takes place on our sound stations in Cumbernauld. A nasty bit of business here with the arm, you know, which is a prosthetic, and the blood bags that are pumping blood and all that. And, you know, we kind of played around with how much of this we wanted to see. You know, do you want to see the full amputation? Do you want to see the bone go through the saw? You know, how gory do you want to be? The point here was to kind of to echo back to episode one of the field hospital, see Claire doing her thing with a wound, with literally a wounded soldier, you know, and starting to bleed out and saving him, and then working as a nurse once more with the doctor. Didn't really need to get too graphic. It's pretty graphic. It's pretty ugly stuff to look at. You know, when I'm reading pieces of history in this period, and there's various descriptions of doctors of the time, surgeons, you know, in the Navy and in the Army, being able to take a man's arm or leg off remarkably fast, like 60 seconds or less. There are recorded instances of that the doctors could become so practiced that they could cut through the flesh with incredible speed and go whip through the bone with incredible speed. And they developed that because, of course, with practice, but they did it for a reason, because they wanted to get it over with as quickly as possible, because it was extraordinarily painful, as you can imagine. And then Claire comes back up, and we've just got Jack. At one point, we played around with the idea that there was some, that Jack had been, you know, having some kind of sexual, you know, relationship with this corporal. We kind of discarded that along the way. We were playing around with ideas of Jack's predatory nature, and he was maybe preying on men in his own command, with or without their consent. But we kind of we dropped that along the way because it felt like it blurred what the show was about, and that wasn't really the point of this episode. And of course, this is to bring the razor down through the centuries, which is another nice touchstone of reminding the audience not only of the fact that there was Frank, but also just playing on the time travel of it, that the very razor that she had shaved Frank with in the 20th century was a family heirloom, and she saw it being used in the 19th century. We thought that that was a cool, a nice, interesting little bit of business and texture to the show. I love, you know, if Terry was here, she would probably talk about that nightgown that Clara's wearing. It's a lovely peach shade. It's sort of reminiscent of the outfit that she wore in episode one, without being the exact same one. And it's just a great bit of costuming. This is where it really does start to become the two-man or two-person play, as it were. Where I really feel like from this point forward, we're just in a theater, you know, watching a stage performance. And this whole beat here, what's Jack going to do? And there's something just instinctively disturbing about the straight razor and a neck of someone that's pissed you off and you could kill them at any moment. And what is Jack going to do? But again, the way Tobias is playing that and his sort of casualness and the way that the anger comes and goes, you know, like Quicksilver in Jack's character, but he can dismiss it as easily as he summons it. Now, one thing that's interesting to me about this show in particular is this set. This is a great set that our production designer, Gary Steele, designed, because it has to hold and sustain your interest all the way through this, where there's really nothing else going on. We don't really go outside of this building except for the comings and the goings at the beginning and end of the episode. And to be locked in this one set was certainly a challenge that Gary, you know, took up and I think pulled up, because I love this set. The colors, that blue, the way the walls are painted, that shade of blue, it works very nicely with the red coats, and there's something interesting and comforting about it and elegant about this place. It feels right that it was selected by the general, that this is where the general would have held his dinner with his officers in this town where they had set up sort of a temporary field command. And that there's an elegance to it, but there's also, and it feels slightly out of place in Scotland, that the Scotland that we've seen heretofore, which has mostly been much more down, much more, places that are more beat up and more workaday. And here's like this somewhat elegant room, and I just love this set because it contains the drama, and it, without commenting on it, it's not too showy, it's not overdone, it feels real. I feel like I'm in a real place. I feel like there is a world just outside that window, and yet all the drama is keeping me at this table and between these two characters. So here we flashback. It's the one flashback we do back to that moment. I love the idea that the first thing Jack does is apologize for that encounter, because he's, you know, diffusing her worry and anxiety. He's trying to lull her into trusting him at least a little bit and thinking that maybe there is a way out of this situation. And it's just very smart. I like the fact that this is a show about two very smart people coming at this situation from completely different perspectives, obviously. But I love the idea that Jack is not just coming at her straight ahead and, you know, as a black-hearted villain, as it were, but he's smart. He's working her, he's using different methods, and he's going to get to where he's, to what he's after, but he's not going to rush into it. One of the things I like about the character is that Jack comes in and he always says exactly what he wants at the beginning. He always says, here's what I'm after, this is what I'm about, give it to me, and if you don't, unfortunate things are going to happen. And he means it. And he knows perfectly well she's probably not going to give it to him, and she's probably not going to answer his questions. But in his mind, he has left that door open. He gave her a chance. He is saying, hey, just tell me what I want, and on your way. But he knows good and well that Claire's not going to do that. And truth to tell, there's probably a good chunk of Jack that is hoping that she's not going to go through that door, that is enjoying the fact that he knows what he's capable of, and he's enjoying watching her squirm. Some of this dialogue is taken directly from the book, this whole testing of the accents, and playing around with, where he's from. In the book, there was a little bit more of that. He called Corporal Hawkins in the book and had him, I think, recite some verse in his native accent and ask Claire if she could figure out where the corporal was from, and she could answer. So it was a little bit more testing and playing around with the idea of accents and language that didn't feel like we really needed it in this scene, because I kind of felt that once we were alone with the two of them, I didn't want to bring him in again or keep him there longer than necessary, that the drama in this scene is really between the two of them. It's a tricky thing. If you're Claire, trying to maintain your cover and trying to find the right balance of outrage and indignation while acknowledging the power of the captain and trying to keep your cover all the while, inwardly there's terror, and inwardly you're really worried about how am I going to get the hell out of this room. And it was also interesting to keep emphasizing Jack's point of view as a military officer in this situation, that there are rebels out there as far as he's concerned, declared or not. There is an undeclared war as far as Jack is concerned, and that his questioning of this woman does have to do with legitimate military information in his point of view, that he really does suspect her of being some kind of spy. He really does think that she has divided loyalties. He is determined to get to the bottom of that question. And then we were trying to come up with, okay, if what could Claire tell this guy to sort of send him on his way, and to come up with this other story of this love affair, and she has to admit something. She's got to give this guy something. She can't just keep holding to her story because he's clearly not satisfied with that. Evidently there's a dispute among the children. I'm fascinated with the way Tobias plays this, What's he thinking? The sort of casual nature of it, the vaguely amused sense of it. Again, he's not showing his hand as an overt villain in any of this. And she's playing it wonderfully. She's selling this. She's selling this idea of an embarrassed woman who had done something that was untoward in the time. She's smart enough to give him something to hold on to. She tears up a little bit. She's playing the part to perfection. And this seemed like the most plausible, explanation that she could come up with. Lots of just quiet. I when I was going through the editing on this particular episode, I just wanted lots of silence. I wanted lots of pauses. I wanted to just, increase the tension bit by bit, wonder what he's going to do. Now, this sequence right here originally was written and shot that while he's sharpening his pencil and starting to draw her likeness here, this was the section where she was actually telling the story about the officer that she had the affair with. But I kind of felt like it would be more effective if his drawing took place almost in silence, that we don't know what he's doing and that she doesn't know what he's doing. Because when it played, when he was doing this simultaneous with her telling the story of the affair with the officer, it felt like we knew that Jack wasn't buying a word of it because he's busy doing something else and that he wasn't even listening to her story. And I felt like we should wonder for a moment whether he's buying it or not. So I separated it. It took some tricky editing by our editor, Michael Halloran, to sort of create, to separate those two scenes, because again, they were shot to be concurrent. So he had to find reaction shots of Claire to go to and Jack, where you couldn't see that Claire was talking, to sort of separate those elements and make it feel like two different sections of the scene. And again, we're not seeing what he's doing, you know, by choice, because we didn't. I wanted to hold that for a while. The whole thing of Jack doing her likeness and drawing her a picture of her is something that Ira grabbed as it was something that was in the book, and he used it, I think, to good advantage here. It adds this other flavor from Jack that you're not expecting. You really don't expect that he has, you know, you wouldn't expect that he has an artistic talent, that there's something that he would be compelled or driven or even inspired to do this, especially in the scene, much less that he had the talent to do it. But the English officers at the time were an interesting group. They did have other interests. They were involved. They were interested in some of them were interested in music and literature and art, and I thought that was an interesting element to make sure that we played on, that was part of Jack's character as well. One of the purposes of this episode was to try to flesh out Black Jack Randall, to sort of make him a really complicated, interesting character in the minds of the audience, that he wasn't just a straight-ahead villain. That was the crucial thing to me, that he wasn't just black. He just wasn't black or white, that there were undercurrents of darkness in him, but there were these other elements that were more recognizably human, that you could possibly reach on some level, that you could reason with, that gives hope. Because the trick of doing an episode like this, if you're going to play cat and mouse, there has to be an element of maybe she's going to get out of here, maybe this is going to work, maybe there is a human being that she can reason with on some level. So you had to find other shadings of this man and his actions and things that are revealed about his character in order to believe the idea that Claire might be reaching him at one point. There had to be sort of ups and downs and hills and valleys through this whole dialectic between the two characters. And if he was just a flat-out villain who was just twirling his mustache, so to speak, you would never kind of get to the suspense. And the suspense is she going to find a way out? Is it going to work? You know, what's the next move? It has to be move and counter-move to sustain it across, you know, an entire episode like this. Just another brilliant performance by Katrina here. You can see the fear, you feel for her, but she's putting up a brave front, even as Jack demolishes that front, you know, brick by brick. And then this leads into the key of the episode to me is Jack talking about the flogging of Jamie. We had not shown the flogging yet. You know, you had seen him beat Jamie in their first encounter at Lollybrook, and Jamie had talked about being flogged by Jack Randall and flogged twice nearly unto death, but he hadn't seen any of it. I thought it was more interesting if instead of showing the flogging flashback from Jamie's point of view, because you kind of know what that's going to be. Here's the victim, here's the guy who's this horrible thing was done to, and playing from his point of view and perspective, you know, what he felt and how horrible it was and all that. You kind of see that coming. You kind of know what those beats are going to be about. There was something really interesting about hearing the story of the flogging and seeing it for the first time from Jack's point of view. What was going through his mind as he did this to young Jamie? And now we begin the first real flashbacks to Fort William. Fort William is a place in Scotland called Blackness Castle. It was a location we scouted very early on in the process, and it was when I first scouted it, it was potentially a place when we were looking for Castle Leix. But as soon as we walked around the courtyard, it didn't feel like Castle Leix, but I immediately said, this is a potential Fort William, because it is such a forbidding, barren, just heavy fortress. It's actually on the water, and Black Ness is incredibly cold. It's a very cold location. The wind, because it's right on the water, the wind tends to whip around this area. It's freezing cold down there, day or night. And there was something about it. As soon as you walked into that courtyard, and you could walk in it today as a tourist, you feel the oppression. You feel the heavy nature of it, and those giant walls, and all that rock and stone, and you just feel the brutality of it. And so I kind of put in the back of my mind as a potential Fort William once we got to do those episodes. Jamie's back is once again a wonderful prosthetic job done by our prosthetics and makeup artists. We didn't really digitally enhance it. What we would do is we would blur the makeup lines and sort of where the prosthetic meets Sam's back. We would clean that up a little bit because over time the makeup lines become a little bit more pronounced, and with sweat and just wear and tear, you start seeing the prosthetic more and more. So we would digitally clean it up, but the rest of it is actually just a prosthetic. Even the blood that you're about to see flow here is actually from blood packs hidden in his costume and pumped out through small tubes. This is a hard sequence to watch, and through editing, the question was always, how much do you want to see? And I just sort of went with my own gut on it, and I wanted to make it hard for me to look at, but not to the point where I had to keep turning away. So this is about as brutal as I personally wanted to see the flogging, and about as far as I personally wanted to watch this, and yet to make it something that I couldn't turn away from. And as Jack starts telling the story and we start getting into his mindset and you're drawn into his point of view, I find that when I've showed this sequence to people in the production or to friends, everybody reacts, especially right there, everybody kind of grimaces and turns their way, but they always turn back, and you're just kind of compelled to keep watching this. And it was necessary to show a good chunk of this because you needed to understand how horrific this was, both to understand what Jamie went through, but also to understand what Jack's talking about. And as Jack gets more involved in this story, the horror that he's talking about had to be sort of realized and had to be made literal for the audience. Now, in some of the shots when Jack is wielding the cat of nine tails, many times when he's coming close to Jamie's back, there actually aren't any straps on the cat of nine tails. It was just a stick, a handle that he's holding in his hand, and then we added the lashes themselves in post for safety reasons. I love that look of Jack. That's really hard stuff. Looking at the skin literally falling, peeling off of Jamie's back. It's just horrific. It was hard on the set. I wasn't there the day that they shot this, but there was a general sort of reaction that as people watched this sequence on the location, it was hard to watch for even the jaded crew and for people, because this was tough stuff that we were doing. I love this beat as Jack walks up, takes him by the hair. And just yells into his face. Again, there was something about the physicality of it, of him losing himself in it, his determination to break this man, and getting lost in it, and the blood. This is a fantastic sequence. This was incredibly well directed by Brian Kelly. The performances, across the board are really good. The fainting is something that was drawn from the book. We added the sort of element from Jack's point of view. The thing that really pisses him off is sort of, that then people are starting to laugh, and that everything is going sideways from his perspective. That's, the punishment is actually inspiring people, is actually making them sympathize with him. You'll notice we're not even showing all these blows. You're just sort of, we're just seeing more of reactions and Jack than we are seeing the actual blows hitting the back, because a lot of this stuff is, the implication of the horror of it is stronger in the mind's eye than it is sometimes on film. I could see the beauty. There was something amazing about that line and the way he delivers it. I had long conversations with Tobias about this long speech, and he and I and Ira spent some time in my office in Scotland going through it, you know, working through the dialogue. Tobias is a very smart actor. He had a lot of great suggestions for lines to pair out and lines to add, little nuances along the way. This is one of the great things about doing a television show, is the collaboration that you're involved with, when you have the actor involved and the director and the writer, and everyone is just working the material and going through it and rehearsing and talking through the idea, and it just gets stronger and stronger until it becomes, you know, something greater than it ever was at the beginning. It's also interesting here, you know, Katrina has a tough role in that Katrina, through that whole section, can only react and react silently. But every time we cut to her, and the look on her face, I think, is tremendous. And it just strikes this perfect balance of the horror of it, the brutality of it, the humanity is there written in her eyes, her sympathy for Jamie, and yet she's trying to find a way to reach Jack even in this moment. Is there a humanity in there just from the way he tells this story? That she can reach, that she can get, that she can touch on, that she can play on to get herself out of this situation. The fact that you care what I think tells me that maybe there's hope. And he wasn't expecting her to say that. I think that's one of the times when she takes him off guard. And I think from Jack's point of view, you know, this isn't really part of the book, but we kind of felt like, for the show, I like the idea that from Jack's point of view, Scotland did this to him, that he wasn't this man in his mind before he came to Scotland and started dealing with, you know, rebels and guerrillas and atrocities and, you know, strikes and counter-strikes, and got lost in it. And I think he does blame this country and these people for turning him into this monster. Whether or not this is who he was, you know, beneath it all anyway, whether this darkness was always there and just looking for a way to express itself is like a different question. From Jack's point of view, this was something that was done to him. And there was something interesting about the fact that Claire has seen war. Claire has been around soldiers. There were atrocities in the Second World War on both sides. And Claire knows what combat can do to men, and, you know, and things that happen in war that, you know, good men of, you know, of decent backgrounds do in horrific circumstances, and that she could draw upon that experience and upon that knowledge as a way to get inside of Jack's head, into his psyche, and find a way to turn the key in the lock that might actually spring her. And that he seems to be really thinking about it. Now, the debate, you know, that goes on is, was he ever going to let her go? You know, I think if she had told him the truth from his lights, if she had told him a story that he really thought was true, I think he would have let her go. Now, does he mean that? Is that part of the game? Is that Jack revealing something about himself? Does he himself hope for redemption? Does he think he's irredeemable? Is it all just part of a cat and mouse game? I think everyone can draw their own conclusion. I think Tobias's performance allows us as an audience to read into the character whatever we want to see. And I think that's a wonderful bit of ambiguity. And I think that makes him a fascinating and dynamic character. Now this, from this moment until the hit, until he hits her, plays so well. I really am proud of the actors and the director and the way this all plays out, because I think you do buy into this notion that for a moment, maybe she really is going to walk. Maybe he is going to let her go. Or that even if you think that something's going to trap her and something's going to go sideways, you kind of think that she's going to give something away, or maybe somebody's going to intervene at the last moment and come in with some information. But it feels like we're playing this where maybe he really is going to let her go. And it's sort of it's the one sort of up moment in the whole piece. It's like, whoa, well, maybe that's all right. He holds out his hand. I love this. She takes it. She's standing. And then without warning, boom. Now, the punch in the stomach is drawn directly from the book. I love the way Katrina plays that. For anyone who's ever had the wind knocked out of them, that reads so true, and that feeling of desperate to just draw a breath of air. And then this little bit of business coming up here with the corporal is just so horrific. I know I keep using that word, horror and horrific, but it all reads that way to me. This idea of, have you ever kicked a woman? What? And this poor kid who's like, what? What'd you just say? It's very freeing. I love the way he says that. Come here. It's very freeing. And the corporal's like, really? Me? I think this was Ira's idea when we were breaking the story, that, you know, that it wasn't so much that Jack keeps hurting her, it was that he was getting some innocent to come in, and that this guy would be ordered to hurt her and kick her, that there was a particularly, you know, disturbing element to this. From the look on his face, it's soft. They're soft. And just before he's going to do it again, thank God, to the rescue, Dougal McKenzie. I love that, the way he just walks up on that kid, and the kid is like retreating as fast as he can. We played around with how could Dougal get her out of this scene, and it was only by, we realized really the only way out, yes, he has the legal thing about she's under the protection of the Clan McKenzie and so on. But, you know, on a certain level, the legalisms aside, the real thing that gets her out is Dougal saying, you'll have a war here today, and are you prepared for that? And that Jack Randall, he might not be swayed by the legalism of it, he might be willing to debate the legalism of it, but he's not quite really prepared to actually start a war with the Scots. He doesn't want to take on that responsibility, because he's no fool, and he certainly would have been exceeding his authority in that moment, and Jack is not a man who wants to put himself at risk. So that did carry the day. And he just believes that it's fine. Walk out of here, and if she doesn't come back, I'll have you too. Fans of the book will know that on the way out, in the original, Claire made a comment about Jack's wig being crooked. Didn't feel like that was part of the show. Didn't feel like she should have that comeback line in this version. And also, you know, Jack's not really wearing a wig. You know, the way that we're playing that is just his hair pulled back. So we didn't decide not to give her a line. Just let her give one last look on the way out. Great scene, great sequence. Just one of the highlights of the show is that whole scene in the tavern. I just think is wonderfully played, and it's one of the things I'm proudest about in the series to date. Now, this upcoming sequence was taken from a different section of the book, St. Ninian's Spring. We in the writers' room kept loving the idea of we kept calling it the 18th century lie detector test, which was kind of cool. And I like the idea of telling the audience that even Dougal, who seems like a very rational guy, is a man of his time, that does believe in superstition, does believe in these kinds of legends, and that he does buy this idea of St. Ninian's Spring that would literally burn out your gullet if you drank from the water and told a lie, and that it's as simple as that he will believe her if she does this kind of thing that we in the 21st century feel is absurd, but it meant something to him, and that Claire walks into without even understanding that she's being tested in the moment. This was a particularly difficult location that Brian found that caused a lot of grief, but he was adamant on how much he loved this location, so we went for it. The crew and the camera and the actors had to be winched down into that particular gully there to get. So it was a very difficult place to go down and shoot, but it looks fantastic, and it doesn't look like any other sort of location I've seen on other TV shows. Quick Eyes will tell you that shot, that quick shot from behind Dougal's back, is part of the sequence that is in the main title every week of somebody holding a knife behind their back, and it was taken from that moment. It's just such a simple explanation. Oh, you know, you drank the water, and so you must be telling the truth. It's like, really? That's it? And, you know, again, Claire is here through some kind of power of magic or some power or something that she knows not what. So on a certain level, even though she thinks that's nonsense, you know, she's had a pretty extraordinary experience, and there's a part of her that I think is wondering, well, what is Saint Denis in spring? I'm not sure we should have included those lines. I think we probably overthought it a little bit and said that, oh, you know, he had been talking to Ned Gowan because he had anticipated this eventuality. I think that probably is stretching it a little much. I don't know that we really should have had him say that. At the time, it felt like we needed a justification for how Dougal, who doesn't seem like a very legalistically minded character, would know all these, you know, this question of citizenship and English law and so on. And so we sort of say, well, he's been talking to Ned Gowan because he had anticipated this. I think that's kind of bullshit. So if I had to do it again, I probably would have cut those lines either at the script stage or in editing or something, but whatever. And the question is, of course, who's she going to marry? Fans of the book know exactly where this is going, and the question was with the audience who don't know the books, and would they know it until Jamie Fraser walks up? It really is sort of interesting, you know, at this point, we're essentially starting the next episode. You know, this is now, we've sort of left the Garrison Commander episode, and this whole little end coda piece is really the beginning of the next episode in a way. One of the things that we're always discussing in the writer's room as we're doing the adaptation is where do the hours begin and end? What is the discrete ending of any particular chapter of the television story? And it kind of felt like we wanted to go up to the point of the marriage proposal from Dougal and go out on the question of will she do it or will she not marry Jamie? Even though that is kind of part of the next episode, looking back, I still think that's the right decision. I don't think there was a natural ending to the Garrison Commander episode that would have ended on a cliffhanger. I definitely didn't want to extend the story in the Garrison Commander episode. You know, in other words, excuse me, I did not want to leave her in the room with Jack and then pick up the next episode and see her get out and then do all these scenes and then get into the following episode. I felt like I wanted to push past that. I wanted to wrap up the Garrison Commander storyline, get out of Jack Randall, and then set the stage for the next episode. But, you know, your mileage may vary. You could carve these episodes up in a lot of different ways, depending on where you think the dramatic conflict is and where the arc takes you. My choice was to go this direction, but we still had to play around with this ending in particular. I would say, if anything, we probably, you know, looking back, we may not have played enough of Claire's particular, how freaked out she should still be. That was a note that Sony, Chris Parnell, who's an executive at Sony, gave the note. He thought Claire wasn't quite freaked out enough here in the aftermath of the whole Jack Randall experience. And, you know, he might have had a point, really. You know, maybe we should have played her a little bit more freaked out. At the time, I felt kind of strongly that, you know, she should be over it. I wanted to move on into the next story and not sort of have the emotion of what had happened in the encounter with Jack Randall coloring these sequences where the question is about the marriage and will she marry Jamie or not. And so I opted to sort of make her, much more together and sort of that she's put it all behind her and that she's moving on. But, you know, again, these are judgment calls that you can kind of go one way or the other on. So that's episode 6, Garrison Commander. Like I said, it's one of my favorite episodes. I hope you enjoyed it. Enjoy might be an odd word to use in a lot of ways and things that you've seen in this episode. But I'm proud of it. I hope you enjoyed it. And I will talk to you again for episode 107, The Wedding. Until then, thank you for listening and good night and good luck.